been talking for the last, what is it, 7 days? 7 days about freedom. One of the important and determining concepts, ideas, vocational goals, meanings of America. And we've been talking about Heil Brunner, whose notion of freedom is quite American in that it emphasizes self-initiation. And I've been trying to indicate how inadequate that notion of freedom is and how destructive it's become in the light of the fact that the content of freedom or of self-initiation has been economic growth, and how inadequate, destructive, impossible, and unchristian that notion of freedom is if the substance of freedom becomes economic growth. Now today I want to take the other concept that's been important in American history, equality, and to, that's rather cryptic, summary of what we've been doing, but that's really the essence of it. Today I wanted to deal with the other concept that's really been part of the American vocation. You could say the American vocation has been to free people under God to achieve what they more or less wanted in the context of the concept of equality. Now I guess what I've been saying in the last seventh session is that under God has been forgotten. The meaning of being free under God has been forgotten, and it's been a freedom to do as one pleases. And today I want to talk a little about what it means to be free under God and to be directed by the concept of equality. There is a sense in which the concept of equality gets at the sum of what it means to be free under God. That's to say, if one accepts the notion that all people are created by God, and therefore one is related to all people through God the Father, then one has some relationship to everyone and is not free to do as he pleases in relation to anyone, except he consider the other one an equal, ultimately an equal, and hence entitled to everything that he is entitled to. And that's created a lot of problems. And what I want to talk about today, partly because some of you were interested in it, is what it means to be free if you're a black person, and equal if you're a black person. It'll center on the notion of equality and how one brings about equality, thinks about equality from the point of view of being black. That seems to me the Christian faith is saying that we are all brothers and sisters, used to be brothers and sisters, and that insofar as we are, we have a responsibility for relating to each other and for taking care of each other, and that since that's a very difficult thing to do, the least we have to do is work for justice for each other, which is a kind of rough equality of opportunity for each other, or a rough equality of results for each other. And those two concepts can be quite different. Now, I began to be interested in this a long time ago, and I don't know why, but I spent some time in a Quaker work camp in the heart of Chicago's ghetto, and I used to spend some time in Buffalo in a black church working with a youth group while I was assistant minister. And then in the Church Federation in Chicago, I really began to work on the problem of equality. And we thought that somehow we could bring about more equality for black people if we could get people to think about the problems of equality. And we spent a lot of time trying to educate people, the white people, and to make pronouncements. I never will forget when in my own area we were redoing the area, the urban renewal program in Hyde Park, Kenwood. And we wanted to provide some low-income housing. We were uprooting about 3,000 black families, and we weren't putting housing back that they could afford. Housing we were putting back, you know, it begins about, I guess you can get a room and a half for about $190, and the housing simply wouldn't take care of them. So the proposal was that we put 120 units of low-rise public housing scattered throughout Hyde Park, and I remember taking that proposal through the Church Federation machinery that we ought to support that, and then I tried to take it through my own church. And the vote in my church on that proposal was 53-2 against it. I had one vote, and there was one other woman for it. It was 120 units. There are now six of those units, and they came about 2 doors from where I lived for a long time. Six units there, and we finally got 60 units, but for the most part, the people in the community didn't want anything to do with housing which would give black people an opportunity to live in our community. So that was my first experience. Then after, we were in Europe for a year, and I came back and went to some of the meetings. I went to the March on Washington, and then they had some meetings afterwards to kind of continue it. And it was kind of accidental, and some people knew I was a minister, so I gave the invocation, and then the guy who was supposed to give the benediction wasn't there, so I gave that. And the result was that I was elected chaplain of what they call protest at the polls. There were 23 blacks and 3 whites on this board of protest at the polls, and I sat through those meetings. Protest at the polls was an attempt to elect black political candidates. I sat through those meetings hour after hour, up to 3 o'clock at night, and nothing much came of it. The attempt was to get some power. Now, the first theory was we could educate the whites and appeal to their goodwill. The second theory was we needed political power, but we had no base. Just a bunch of people trying to elect black candidates without any money, any organization, really, but an idea. Well, the next program that I participated in was community organization. Saul Alinsky came along and organized the Organization for the Southwest Community, and we got involved in that because they wanted someone to write a platform or to establish a ground for what was going to be the basis of the organization. Actually, the organization under Alinsky's theory of self-determination for a community would have been racist because the people in the community they were organizing were really racist. That is, they really, as far as I can see, would vote against everything that would be for integration. And so we were supposed to present a platform. And so my little department in the Divinity School wrote the program for the community. And then we took it to the Methodist bishop. And we wanted the Methodist bishop, Bishop Brashears, to promulgate this program, to issue it. Now, it so happened that the biggest contributor to the Rock River Conference was in this area. And the assistant minister got involved in this organization, caused a big controversy in the church, and the bishop wasn't about to get involved in anything which would oppose that biggest contributor to, and I may oversimplify the reason. So the next morning after I'd met with the bishop and I'd met with some other Methodist, National Methodist leaders with him in order to get him to, try to get him to see, to make a statement of what a Christian position on community life would be. And the next morning he talked about long hair professors. My hair wasn't quite as long as it is now. And so forth, and all their radical ideas and so forth. So that didn't work very well. But we tried to work through that organization. And one of my students finally became the director of that organization. It was an attempt to organize the people of an area to see if through their organization they couldn't bring about equality and overcome the kind of discrimination and segregation that was characteristic of the city. Later we organized TWO, and that was right south of us, and the university fought that tooth and toenail. And at one point, it's very strange, the Christian Century was absolutely opposed to TWO because it was absolutely opposed to Alinsky because it said it was a racist outfit. And at one point, I organized a little committee and sent out 1,500 letters to every minister in the Chicago area in order to counter the editorials that were coming out in the Christian Century. Just happened to be a time when they were seeking money, and so it was the editor who came out to investigate, to find out what was happening at the Divinity School when someone would oppose him like this. But he and the university, the Christian Century and the university, claimed that Alinsky's organization was racist, whereas I've been working tooth and toenail with the organization in order to shift any possibility of it being racist for several months. And it was so contrary to what was the fact, and I knew the organizers. So that was an attempt, these community organizations, was an attempt to organize the community. One was a mixed community. TWO, the Woodlawn organization, was an all-black community. And on the theory that the blacks, if they organized themselves, could achieve some of the things that they needed, and a measure of equality. TWO failed in every one of its major operations because it was one organization fighting the whole city, and it was to the advantage of the mayor and the Democratic political organization not to grant any of the things that TWO wanted that were important. And it was just one running battle between the city, political organization, whose constituency overwhelmingly was racist and white, and with control of enough of the black votes through its organization. I worked in political campaigns, and the one campaign I worked in out in the South for Sammy Rayner, who was running for Congress against the black, who was the incumbent and a member of the party. And there were three people on the payroll of the city in this little precinct who were working for it, so that it was almost impossible I remember the vote came out 65 to 13, 65 for the incumbent, and it was a very strange thing. I went out and put up my posters about 5 o'clock in the morning, and by 5:30 they were all down, of course, because the organization had taken them all down. And then the guy who was in control of the precinct for the party said, well, he said, we'll get 63 votes and you get a few. And as a matter of fact, one person on the ballot who had nobody working for him, but he was first on the ballot, got more votes than my candidate did, and I've been out there 2 or 3 days with several people working and organizing. But the effort, of course, was to get power, and the TWO simply wasn't able to mount enough power over against the city. My next operation was the Coordinating Council of Community Organization. They got involved in a fight against the superintendent of schools, and what they claimed, and what I would affirm, was a segregated policy in education, gerrymandering and doing all kinds of things in order to prevent integration in education. Their theory was that only by integration would you get a good education. I'm not sure that's a true theory, but they thought it was true, and they could see that only where white students were the resources put in for good education. So we tried to get rid of the superintendent of schools. And in the summer of 1965, we had 100 marches, which I organized, down through the city to the city hall in order to overcome the the in order to somehow mount enough public opinion against the superintendent to get rid of him. I think we got rid of him, but it came later, and I'm not sure how effective. What we would do would be to start out about 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon and wind our way downtown, and sometimes we'd try to go in the street and cause disruption. Sometimes people would sit down in the street and then they'd get arrested. Sometimes they'd walk on the sidewalk. And you could say it was a kind of combination of appeal to the goodwill, education, and kind of a disruptive tactic, a kind of an harassment. And some Dick Gregory was the leader of the marches. Al Raby was the guy I worked with, the black leader of the coordinating council. And I was kind of his administrator. Not kind of, I was. And the result was that I think we finally got rid of the superintendent. But we didn't change anything in the city, and Gregory used to lead us all over the city sometimes, just to use the time of 100 or 150 police, and I never could see the purpose of it, really, but I'd agreed to work and do whatever was needed in this program, and so I kept doing the administrative work for it. And it produced some very interesting things. Once King was coming to town, we organized a meeting for King. A meeting, we organized 3 days, 15 community meetings with, I suppose, from 5 to 6,000, 3 to 6,000 maybe in each community meeting. We had a march with 30,000 people and all kinds of things. And Gregory wanted to march out around the mayor's home a couple of nights before King was coming. And so Raby and I had to go and plead with Gregory not to do this. We didn't want to have any incidents or anything happen. And Gregory was just furious with us. And I never worked so hard trying to get a guy not to do something. So about 4 or 5 nights later, he really organized it. So he put Raby and me in one group. This was a kind of night march. And he put us on the subway in the elevated, and we got off the elevated. We were supposed to go on the elevated and kind of confuse the police, I guess. Why, when we got off and we were standing down on Randolph and Madison, we got arrested. You know, we weren't doing anything, and I think it was Gregory's attempt really just to get even with us. And he thought if we got on the L and they get us for disrupting or nuisance or something, and they did. They didn't have a case. The only guy who fought the case won it, but all the rest of us, if you pleaded guilty, you got off at $25. If you were guilty, it was $200, and we didn't have the money to pay that, so we all pleaded guilty, but we were in jail for a while, and it was quite an experience in a way, but funny incidents occurred. I remember when I was testifying for this guy who finally went through it, I just bought a new pair of pants, and I went to get up to testify, and all the money came out. I always carry a lot of change, and all went all over the courtroom. So I picked it all up, got on the chair and testified. I got up again, and it all fell. Boy. You know, these funny things you remember. There was a new pair of pants and there was a hole. I couldn't believe a new pair of pants. Well, then the next thing that came along, and I don't want you to lose sight of the humanness of it, but it's the theory I'm interested in. What the theory was, what the interpretation was behind the activity. Here, with the coordinating council, we are appealing largely to public opinion. We weren't affecting anybody's real interest in the community. It was an attempt to get the headlines and to cause people to think. But the actors, the ones who made the decisions, you see, were not really affected. We did a little bit in the beginning for State Street business, but not much in the end because we were so controlled that it really didn't disrupt anything. Well, then SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, came to town. And Martin Luther King, he was looking for a place in the North. He had won his battle in the South in terms of the right of people to use public transportation and to be served, but he saw the issues as being economic and political, and he wanted to try to do something in the large city. So Jim Bevel, his chief lieutenant, came to town in the fall of 65, and he came to town, and we finally made an agreement that they would come to town, and we had many, many long sessions trying to figure out a strategy. And finally, the strategy consisted of two parts. One, that they would try to organize rent associations, tenants associations, on the theory that the tenants had some economic power and they could control their rents. And somehow, through the control of their rents, they would affect enough of the people who were important in the city. And our other strategy was to begin to educate the city about the lack of equality of opportunity in housing by moving into the white neighborhoods. And what we did was to send some white people into a real estate office in the white neighborhoods to rent. And then we'd send a black group, a black couple into the neighborhood. And in about 70 cases, which I still have in my file, no black person was ever shown or allowed to even be considered to rent or sell any housing. Now, there was a statute in the city of Chicago that made it mandatory that any real estate broker who was licensed by the city had to rent, sell, show, regardless of race, color, national origin, all the rest of the stuff, you know, that goes in that phrase. But none of them would. So what we're trying to do is to call attention to the city that these real estate agents were breaking the law every day. And we organized all kinds of things. We'd organize shopping tours in these areas. And finally, one day, King came in to a small meeting we were having and said, well, he says, the summer's getting along, it's getting hot. I'm afraid something's going to happen if we don't speed up things and get something going which will take the pressure off the black community, make them think something's happened. So then we decided to begin to picket these real estate offices. So we decided to picket an office along 55th Street out in Gage Park. That's about 3000 West and about 5500 South. And so we went out there that night and we started late afternoon. Crowds gathered, and we had a few police, I think about 25, and there were about 3,000 white people, and we were about 25 standing around the real estate office praying, and so finally we decided we had to get out, just get out, it was too dangerous, so the police took us out, and I know I was mad, because why didn't the police protect us? And I never will forget Bevel saying, well, you know, keep... Don't worry, I was ready to call the chief of police because I'd had some dealings with all these people at one point or another. He said, keep your eye on the goal. I never will forget. He said, don't worry, the police are not the issue. The issue is housing, and don't get off on a side issue. That was a real lesson I learned. Whenever you're trying to do anything, stick to what you're trying to do, and don't let anything on the side, peripheral kind of issue, get you involved. Well, that started a whole series of marches, and Sarah and I were organizing them. We were the administrators for these marches, too. The leaders were Bevel and Jackson and Raby, in theory, but Bevel and Jackson kind of took over with a constant tension. I was always in the middle between SCLC and the Chicago organization, since Raby and I kind of represented the Chicago organization at the level of administration, and Bevel and Jackson, the SCLC, and the constant tension.
But Sarah and I were doing the administration behind the scenes, but we were on most of the marches. And the marches in Gage Park, we got up to 1,500 in marching at one point in three different neighborhoods, and we had 1,500 police protecting us. And at one point, I never will forget one march when in Gage Park, that's the time they burned all our cars out there, threw them in the ponds, and burned the cars. I don't know how our car, my son had driven our car out, And I'd rolled down the window, so my sign wasn't showing, but somehow that got rolled up, but they didn't get our car. I still can't figure it out. We got out of the pond later, that I was out of the auto pond later, and it had not been thrown into the water or overturned or burned or anything. But for about 12 blocks, we didn't have any police protection. They were throwing rocks and bottles and stones and pieces of steel, anything they could get at us, firecrackers. And that occurred. Sometimes you'd have 5,000 or 6,000 against you. Once we went out on the bus, I never will forget that, because we were very ordered. But as soon as we got on that bus, they hired CTA buses to take us out because it was just too much tension. Police brought them in. And so some of the white youth were throwing stones at the bus. The police started after them. And this non-violent, you know, well-disciplined group, at almost to a person in the bus, said to the police, "Go get him! Go get him! Go get him!" You know, we were so non-violent while we were marching, but as soon as we got a little protection, all of our feelings came out. So that summer went along, and we really caused so much disturbance. These were Catholic neighborhoods largely, and we had nuns and priests in their garb, and it was just causing havoc with the Catholic Church. And it was also causing havoc with the mayor, because the mayor's police were attacking and putting in jail. They didn't put them in jail, they didn't let them go, they didn't do anything with the white community, but they had to attack, they had to keep order, and so they were getting a lot of flack from the white community. Because the white community was being oppressed by the police.
So the powers that be in the religious organizations in the city, the Catholic Church, Protestant Church, and the Jewish organization, the liberal Jewish organization, decided it was time for mediation. They called for mediation. And we had a great discussion as to whether we ought to call off the marches. Well, by that time, they had an injunction out against us. We couldn't march. We could only have 500 a day marching. Courts put this injunction through. We couldn't march between 8 and 10 in the morning and 4 and 7 in the evening. And we always started about 2, and we never got home until 7. So that the conditions for our marching, we always had to have the exact route of our marches. The conditions were such that it was very difficult to continue these. Our plan was to do this right through the white communities and out into the suburbs, to lift up to the people the reality of the housing situation, namely that the real estate agencies and the people of the white communities simply would not accept blacks. That we were really going to try to lift up the problem. Here you had in the heart of the ghetto, crowded, about 3 times as dense as anywhere as the rest of the city, a black community, and it was simply impossible for it to get housing under the same conditions. We had all the facts that you would pay about 25% more in the ghetto, and your conditions were much less desirable for the same apartment, the same physical apartment. As you paid a tax for living in the ghetto because of the pressure. You simply paid more money for less. Less in terms of services, less in terms of greenness, less in terms of everything. So we finally decided, because of all kinds of things, that there's no way for us to do anything but negotiate. At least that was the decision. And a lot of the black people felt that this was a sellout. And I never will forget, in one of the negotiating sessions, I got in the negotiating sessions kind of by the back door as the secretary of our group, which I was kind of the secretary and administrator for the governing body, and went through all the negotiations. And then the final session with all the powers that be, it was fairly interesting to sit in the room with all the powers, and all the people representing the power in the city were in that room, because this was a real threat to the mayor, and he'd marshaled everybody. We had the power to bring
them to the negotiating table, at least. So everybody had been working out programs, what they were going to do to change, to bring about more equality for the black community. And so Raby said, well, the least you'll do for our calling off the marches for a while is to remove the injunction. Then the president of the Church Federation, Presbyterian by the name of Zimmerman, got up and said, no, what we need is to put all of this in the hands of the courts. The king was sitting right across from me. He said, yeah, $250,000 and 2.5 years down the pipe. Mayor controlled all the judges in the state of Illinois. And as up until the Supreme Court, the mayor was in control. I mean, he had been instrumental in all of their appointments. And I remember one other connection when the hod carriers, now called the Laborers Union, representatives came to me and they said, you know, we went into the office of Judge Merowitz with our case of discrimination. There were 15,000 blacks in the Laborers Union, out of 25,000, there were 15 locals and no black was a member of any. They'd simply been excluded from any power and they were taking their case to the courts. And Merowitz said, you got a good case, but he took them into his office and showed them the pictures on the wall. He said, you know, those are people put me in office. Nothing I can really do. So the net result was that we made an agreement, and again, Sarah and I kind of policed that agreement, and nothing occurred really of any significance. There were a few token actions, and the movement was completely decimated by the cry of sellout and the feeling that it had been sold out. And that was the end of the integrated movement for equality for blacks in the city. From then on, it was black power. I mean, this was a sellout, and the whites had really sold out. Well, in the meantime, Jesse Jackson, who just happened to be a student of mine, but he didn't just happen to be a student of mine, because he had come to the city with introductions to the mayor and the powers that be, and had decided on a different course, and I had gotten him a job and some money, and he'd become a kind of a staff person for the coordinating council, had become the leader for Operation Breadbasket. Breadbasket started in Philadelphia and was a movement to get black people jobs. What they did in Philadelphia was to go into a plant and ask what kind of employment the blacks had, and then say, well, it seems to me you should have blacks here, there, and there, and if you don't want to put blacks in these positions, we'll simply not buy from you. Started in Philadelphia, went down south, they brought it to Chicago, and it started in Chicago in February 1966. Well, I've been a part of that operation from the beginning, too. What I determined about, I suppose about 63, but more in 65, that the future of America was really at stake, and our whole way of life was at stake in preventing a blow-up between blacks and whites, that the stability of America, that this rupture could be so great that we'd have civil war. And therefore, it was important to bridge this rupture, this chasm, what I call the white curtain, the curtain that separated the blacks from the whites. So I was just present, and wherever there was anything going on that seemed fairly important, I was present. I was teaching all the time, but not spending a great deal of time at it, as you can imagine. And so I started out with Breadbasket, and when the movement died, that is, the Chicago movement died, the Coordinating Council, then Breadbasket came to the fore. And Jesse is one of the most powerful persons I've ever met, and I never will forget when I first met him. I was sitting in the back office, as whites were in the Coordinating Council's office. He came and leaned over there, and I looked at that guy, and I began to talk to him, and I said, man, here is the person I've been looking for. This is a man with power of being. And he was one of the smartest, most intelligent, most politically astute persons I've ever met. Our theory then in Breadbasket, this happened, Sarah's brother was with him 7 years, I was with him 5 years, Sarah was with him a couple of years, and we operate on the theory that the only way to get justice, the only way to get equality for the black, given the situation, was not to appeal to the white conscience. That was Myrdal's theory, of course. Gunnar Myrdal in The American Dilemma, that was his theory, that what we needed was to bring about the embodiment of the American ideals of equality and freedom for everybody. And what I had learned in my experience was that that would not happen. Whites simply would not admit the necessity for or engage in the activities to bring about equality for blacks unless they were oppressed. And so over all this period, I developed a theory that came largely, but not exclusively, partly was pragmatic, out of Reinhold Niebuhr's theology, who said that man tends to distort the truth and his own virtue, and if you want to bring about equality, you will organize those who are unequal, and they will assert their interests. And at one point he pointed out that the unfinished business in America is to organize the blacks to bring about an equal opportunity for the blacks. Now those of you who have been following through the last 7 or 8 days will realize that to organize equality for blacks in a society which is problematic as ours is in a sense a subordinate issue to the one we've been talking about. But at that point it seemed to me important for the life of the nation to deal with this issue, or we wouldn't be able to deal systematically with any issue because of the rupture and the split and the friction. That was just my interpretation of the situation. So what we did in Breadbasket was to organize the black community in order to get economic and political power. And we began in this way. We began just like they did in Philadelphia, to move into the companies, the chain stores, the soft drink companies, the bread companies, the companies that sold to black people. And we would go in and say, we're interested in your hiring policies. We want an inventory. We'd ask for a complete inventory of all the jobs, the number of blacks at all levels. And then we would go back and we'd work it over and we'd say, well, the blacks are 30% of the population and they ought to have probably 30% of the jobs, but maybe we'll ask for 20% of the jobs and we'll ask them for all levels. In a chain store, we'd say, if you've got a chain store in the ghetto, we want a black manager. And if you don't do that, we will simply, you know, be unable to buy from you. The blacks will not buy from you. And so we'd sit down and negotiate, and they'd say, well, we can't do this. We haven't got the people. We don't know where to find them. We've got white people. We can't fire them, can we? And the unions won't let us. Remember the wholesale drivers and the milk companies, they would say, well, the unions won't let us put blacks in wholesale routes because they don't have the seniority. We say, we don't care. You know, what's important is to get blacks there. They can do the jobs, and you can find people to do jobs if you want to. And we preach a little about justice and about brotherhood, and they knew we could. They didn't know, but we were forced to do a little picketing, and we found that with about 7 or 8 pickets in a middle-class black neighborhood, we could cut off the business about 90% in a store. In a middle-class area. You couldn't in a lower-class area. I remember once in a lower-class area where I was picketing, I took women, you know, in my car to other stores. You had to have some other stores where they could go, some alternatives. But they had kids at home, and it was a real problem. But in the middle class area, we got a great deal of cooperation. Well, after we'd done that once or twice, then we got quite a lot of coordination, a cooperation from the white companies. I remember once Don Perkins, who was president of Juul, said, well, we were in a negotiating session. He said, you know, I flew back from Japan to deal with you and to be here because I'm a deacon in a church. And Jesse looked at me and winked, you know. He said, yeah, deacon in a church. He didn't say that, but we all knew. He came back in part because it was to his economic advantage to come back and deal with us if we cut off his business. That's power, you see. That's an organization of black power. And we believed in nonviolent. I don't know how nonviolent it is to cut off economic power. We didn't believe in the destruction of property or life, but we did believe in using economic power and political power in order to get some equality. Well, then as we negotiated, we went down the line, and we want jobs. We want you to advertise in black newspapers. We want you to put your money in black banks. We want you to build your buildings with black contractors. My job, all kinds of things I did, everything under the sun for Breadbasket, but one of my special jobs was black contractors. Now I was business agent for 40 black contractors for 5 years, with about $25 million worth of contracts in my hip pocket, as I said, off and on, I mean, over the years. And so I was organizing black contractors and really literally forcing the companies that were building in the ghetto to deal with us. And then on the other hand, I had to organize the black contractors in order to meet the specifications, in order to produce. And one of my problems, and almost insurmountable problem, was to get people who could produce. And I spent a lot of time trying to organize companies. Sometimes I was out there on the ground, almost supervising, on occasion, not very much, but on occasion, trying to get my contractors to come through once we got the job. So it was a very complex job. And we went down the line. We asked for all kinds of things from these companies. And we also tried to organize politically. And the theory is that given white persons' prejudices, and we're all prejudiced, given our tendency to say we are doing all we can do, we're doing more than we should do, not to see the situation as it is, there is no way to get equality of opportunity for blacks except through pressure. Now, we frequently said to a president, you'd like to do something, we know, but you can't because of your directors or because of your stockholders. We'll make it possible for you to do it. We'll put the pressure on you. It'll become economically advantageous for you and to deal with us. You'll lose money if you don't deal with us. So you can now do what you would like to do but couldn't do because you have other people around you who don't want to do it. And in many cases, that was the fact. This Don Perkins was a very, very sensitive, concerned person, and we got tremendous cooperation out of Juul. I dealt with Juul on a number of occasions, all up and down the line, tremendous cooperation. And the fellow who's now president, Christensen, I never dealt with, but he's the same kind of a person. Made a great deal of difference in our dealing who the president was. Because we dealt with the president. We wouldn't settle. In fact, we'd walk out of meetings sometimes when they'd send subordinates. Because we knew that the only way you could get movement was to get it at the top. And if you didn't get it at the top, you wouldn't get any real movement. Well, that's kind of, I think I ought to stop now. That's for some questions. Or some responses. It's try to give you a kind of running story which involves kind of a human element, my human element, but to do it in the context of an interpretation how justice comes about, on the theory that justice comes about by the organization of self-interest. The interaction of self-interest brings about a kind of rough justice. That was Niebuhr's position, the organization of self-interest. Therefore, I used to say, if you want to get justice, if you want to preserve a measure of order, because if you don't have justice in a community, you're going to get disorder. Our social health depends upon justice. If you want to get justice, then encourage the blacks, particularly the nonviolent blacks, to organize themselves and press for equality of opportunity, and that will help the whole community hold together. That's a theory. I think it's still valid. I think it's still necessary, and still a very important way of looking at things.
When you're in a resistance before, was your group all nonviolent? And like, was this all before the riot?
Well, our group was always nonviolent.
Yeah,
it was Southern Christian Leadership.
The violent, more or less violent group was black.
We always had problems with the with people who wanted violence and wanted to disrupt things. But our group was always nonviolent.
Was this a meetup before then, the
riots in Chicago? Well, the riots occurred in and around all the time I was there, but we were not involved in the riots except trying to pick up the pieces. And a very complex story. Some of the groups in the Coordinating Council were accused of being involved in the riots and providing Molotov cocktails and so forth. That's a very complex thing as to whether they did or didn't. But the leadership of the movements that I was associated with were always nonviolent.
Didn't you think it would be frustrating at times, the violent aspect, especially, well, I'm sure it was probably viewed as a setback, but was your goal when it did break into the violence?
Well, no, because it actually helped. I mean, you got, actually, some people began to feel the only way you got anything was to threaten that kind of violence. We didn't agree with it, and we kind of ignored the violence, except that the violent leaders would come in and disrupt our activities frequently. Because you're really infighting in the black community, and there was a real struggle for leadership and a real struggle for power in the black community.
So then you said that when you were boycotting, it was mostly the middle class. Is your whole thing then aimed at the middle class because you could get more of a response from them, or?
No, it was aimed at getting economic opportunity and political opportunity generally. So, you know, it wasn't, the jobs went all over it a lot in terms of who got the jobs. All kinds of people got the jobs, all kinds of people got opportunities. Now you'd say a lot of my activity, I was working with the banks and saving and loans, that's a kind of a middle class operation. The contractors are middle class operations. I create a couple black millionaires, and now I wonder why I did it. But you know, it probably is necessary to do that kind of thing. There's no way to avoid doing it if you're getting equality of opportunity in the situation. So the reason I mentioned the middle class was that's a kind of strategic information that allows you to decide where you're going to pick it. You've got to find all those things out. And we cased all the corporations in the city. We knew, like Carson Peary's, had 23.5% of its charge accounts with blacks. Somehow or other, we got that kind of information and allowed us to pick our targets on the basis of some realistic appraisal of which corporations could be influenced. Carson would have been a good one. Carson, however, was willing to do all kinds of things and negotiate with them. Holly got involved in this, and they were willing to put a store in the ghetto. Unfortunately, just while we were in the midst of that thing, somebody started a fire in Carson's and just caused all havoc. And of course, it set back the whole project. Actually, the project never developed. And I don't know who set the fire, but they you know, you got the feeling that they thought the blacks had done it, and the whole thing broke down because of, that's the kind of fighting and the kind of situations you were involved in, where what the rest of the black community did, who might not be nonviolent, they interfered with what we were trying to do. I don't know whether the blacks did it or not. The fire started there, and it looked like it was arson. And in the midst of all these tensions, the blacks got blamed.
Yeah. Sounds like it could be really extremely frustrated in those 5 or 7 years.
Well, it's both frustrating and not frustrating. So.
How come you're no longer doing it?
Yeah, how come I'm no longer doing it? That's a very complex thing, but, you know, Jesse's half-brother, Noah Robinson, came to town, a very brilliant guy, chemist. He'd done a number of important things, graduate of the Wharton School of Business, and he took over the commercial operations for Breadbasket, and he took the whole operation out from under his brother. And I went through that fight, and I wasn't about to serve anything but the overall. Of course, I was very loyal to Jesse, and also very determined to be a part of a power operation, a complete operation, a whole operation, and not simply a segment. Well, so there I was without a base, and I talked to Jesse several times and about reorganizing under him, but I guess at that point I was so tired after this, you know, working from, I suppose, 70, 80, 90 hours a week without vacation for 5 years, that your energy goes and your creativity goes. And so I put some conditions on my going back, and somehow they were never met. I mean, in the midst of all kinds of busy things, the conditions for my trying to reorganize, and of course, at the same time, I guess I began to feel that what I've been talking about the last 8 days was kind of becoming larger and larger. Namely, that we'll never handle this issue until we handle the problem of the substance of our culture, what we're all about as persons, that our racial prejudice is so deep, and the problems are so deep, that until we get rid of the kind of ethos that drives America and that pushes people into positions where they can't really be creative in relationship to equality of opportunity for all people, till we tackle that problem, we probably will never deal satisfactorily with the black problem. And a combination of things, Scott, personal, intellectual, spiritual, historical. I probably still would be related to it if this split hadn't been. If Noah hadn't come, and I don't know whether it's because they were, you know, fratricide, brothers fighting, whatever you call it, fratricide. That isn't the word. What do you call it? Anyway, sibling rivalry, I guess. But man, that was tough to go through.
I'm surprised the University of Chicago didn't put pressure on you to kind of clear activities. I mean, like you said, like when you got...
Well, you know, we had a lot of problems. Actually, in the midst of this, in 68, we had great uprisings at the university. And the Divinity School was shot through with tensions and 67. So there were great pressure, and so the university actually released me half-time for 67, 68, I think it was 67, 68, 68, 69, one of those years.
To work on a white organization, that's when the blacks were kind of pushing the whites out. So for a year I had a white organization called the Committee for One Society. We would go in and try to program white companies. We'd go in and write a program for them. I had learned a great deal then about what to do about racism, you know. I had about 150 items you look at in a company to deal with racism. You know, where does a company have its festivals, its picnics and so forth? How do they hire? Do they? What kind of an application do they have? And all kinds of things that we had to go through. So they released me with the real blessing of the university, because at that point the students and some of the faculty felt it was important to do something. That was right, it was 68, wasn't it? Right after King died, that came. and the riots and so forth. But after a year, of course, they want me back at the university and kind of resented the fact I was not there more than about 25 or 30 hours a week. And the rest of the time I was in the ghetto. And all the summers I was in the ghetto. And I had a quarter off or so along there. And all those quarters off, I wasn't doing research. I was in the ghetto. But no, I don't think they ever said anything to me. Carol remembers somebody saying something to me, but I don't remember much being said to me. I had tenure. There was nothing they could do as long as I taught my classes. And I was in my classes more than my colleagues. They were out running around the country giving lectures and building up their careers. And so I was in more classes, I think, every quarter than any one of my colleagues. I never missed a class. So, what could they say?
Did you play any part in the 68 convention in Chicago?
Nothing, absolutely nothing. I paid attention to nothing except the Chicago movement. Nothing else. Nothing. But that depends on your theory of power. And my theory of power was that the only way you're going to get power is to build an organization in which you've brought economic benefits to black people and have organized the black people in a way such that you've got them bound into you and you can get some responses you want from them, and therefore you can affect the white people by virtue of this black power movement. So all that headline stuff, for my money, didn't amount to yellow beans in terms of getting people to move. You got to get people to move. Now, how do you get people to move? Not by getting headlines. Once in a while, headlines do. You get people to move when you affect their real interests. And I was able to affect their real interests. Every corporation that built in Chicago where there was an interest in serving the black community, or even they thought, Standard Oil, Sears, when they put up their big buildings, I could walk in to the general contractors, and those general contractors would give me any amount of their business I could handle. Because their corporations were afraid of our organization, our ability to affect their sales. Now, partly it was public image. They were concerned with their public image. But mostly there were 100 gasoline stations of Standard Oil in the ghetto. Sears had a good percentage of its trade with the black community. And so they would deal with us. I was more interested in that capacity to deal than in any headline, personally. Now, Jesse's a little different. Jesse operates at several levels. And one of the problems was that he moved more and more away from this concrete, what I call organizational level. King always operated at the level of public opinion. Really at the level of public opinion. The theory of SCLC was you can appeal to the law and the goodwill of white people. So your marches and your activities affect people's opinion, you appeal to their sense of justice, and you appeal to the law, to the courts. We said, what we're interested in is economic power, where you appeal to their pocketbooks, and political power, where you affect their capacity to get what they want through the government by virtue of your political power. And if you've read that article that I gave you, you know the economic and the political power. I was figuring on getting $100 million worth of contracting business a year. That's partly why I wasn't getting 1% off the top and having $1 million in order to support the movement. I mean, it's very simple. Very, very simple. That's why I was in contracting, because it gave that possibility. I was not interested just in developing black contractors. I was interested in the movement, in its capacity to organize power and affect the life of the city, all over the city, in terms of somebody's notion of what black interests were. And, of course, the question is whose notion of what black interests were. But that was our organization, our executive committee, our directors, and so forth.